control and obligation than they may be accused of.
We're starting on the third slide.
And do you think that this kind of initiative will also promise a level of support to them?
It helps that, yeah, but also the problem is that, that in these situations, both sides feel at a disadvantage.
Absolutely true. They feel at a disadvantage, they also feel that they have nowhere to go, mm-hmm. and they feel therefore isolated and unsupported. So I think your point is very well taken. Healthcare mediation addresses power imbalances to some extent by virtue of the mediator's neutrality as to the parties to the dispute. Now remember, neutrality as to the parties. We're going to come to this and view it in more detail in a few minutes, but neutrality as to the party may be seen as different than neutrality to the outcome. But just bear that in mind as we go along. The inclusive nature of the process and a commitment to the exchange of clear, comprehensible, and comprehensive information. Meaning that part of that anxiety that is being suffered by that patient or family member who is being alienated by being in this new environment is going to be addressed by virtue of the fact that the puzzling language of this atmosphere is in part now going to be translated and clarified for them by the mediator, who is there in large part to form a catalyst for enhancing the quality of the communication between the caregivers, family members, and the patients. And in addition, notice that if we create, and this is certainly what our intention is to do, when we talk about having a mediation program in a clinical setting, we're not talking about a mediation program that gets triggered solely by a caregiver request. I think you understand that it goes without saying that if we were to have that kind of a mediation program, and you're going to see in a few minutes how hospital ethics committees traditionally work in that regard, that would not serve this need very well. The idea here being that the ability to tap this resource must be available to Richard, as you're saying, parties on the caregiver side, but also on the patient and surrogate side. Similarly, healthcare mediation addresses power imbalances through recognition, acknowledgement, validation, and consideration of patient slash family feelings, questions, perspective, and values. And you notice at the end, a moral space. So that the author Walker in 1993, writing about the feasibility and the utility of healthcare mediation, was very concerned about the creation of what she called the moral space. The moral space meaning this protected place where you can go and actually express your needs, thoughts, and feelings without fear of judgment and without fear of being treated in a way that is less equal than the parties on any other part, at any other part of the table. So this empowering function is partly a function of the respect that's accorded to the person who is speaking, inclusive of the patient and family, but it is also a function of the fact that the entire process is being conducted by the mediator in a way that emphasizes the rights and privileges and the equality of being of the parties who are involved in the dispute in the first place. And when that patient in particular experiences that, there's going to be an ability in an effective mediation program to quell some of those fears, quell some of those anxieties, and hence some of those power imbalances. When they feel that comfort level of being in that protected space, which is being, as we learned last week, managed by you. Okay? Now, shifting from that for a moment, if we can have the next slide, I want to talk, I have one more of these. Also, of course, it goes without saying that part of the redressing of the power imbalance comes from the fact that the mediator is not going to be particularly susceptible to facilitating resolutions or outcomes that come about as the result of one or another party's personal preferences. Meaning that the not only that what we learned about the fact that these are consensual resolutions that are generated by the parties, not by an individual, and that they must be accepted by all as better than the alternatives, but they also are resolutions that cannot be founded in my, let's assume I'm Dr. Smith, my religious beliefs or my personal moral preferences cannot be permitted to drive the outcome. And the mediator is in a unique position, not by telling Dr. Smith, oh, Dr. Smith, you're wrong, or Mrs. Jones, you're wrong, but by doing all of the things we talked about last week, probing, providing information, cajoling, being creative, being a catalyst for a dialogue between the parties, to be able to ascertain by that dialogue whether in fact a party is trying to promulgate a resolution that is based on not the needs of the patient and the appropriate treatment of the patient, but rather by personal preferences, biases, or religious beliefs, or cultural beliefs. And mediation is particularly suited for, because of this open-ended dialogue in this morally protected space, suited to being able to diminish the likelihood that you're going to end up with an outcome that is in fact either one-sided or based not on either the needs of the patient and the appropriateness of the medical treatment, but some extrinsic element that shouldn't be driving the conclusion of the problem. Next slide, Katrina. All right, now we're gonna get into the nuts and bolts. And I'm gonna start by showing you what Nancy Dubler, I think years ago, I went to hear her lecture at a symposium in upstate New York, and the first thing that she put on the screen, this is really her slide, although I copied it with her permission, is to distinguish what in her view are the differences between what she calls bioethics consultation versus bioethics mediation. And I continue to find this interesting, and I think you will as well, especially as we go forward. So what she said at that time was that bioethics consultation is a directed substantive process. It's authoritative and hierarchical. As far as the identity of the service provider, it could really be anybody from the hospital, usually from the hospital ethics committee, who is providing that consultation. And unfortunately, for those of you who have not read what's called the Fox Report, the Fox Report has essentially derived the data from the performance and growth of hospital ethics committees since their inception and concluded some pretty scary and negative things about the way they function. And first of all, as I just alluded to 5 minutes ago, this question, who requests a consult from the ethics committee? Well, we know in fact, and this is data, data specific, that the requests are made almost exclusively by doctors, sometimes nurses, but almost all are made by members of the healthcare team, not patients, not family members, not surrogates. So our eyes pop open a little bit. I'll come back to that. But let's look at Nancy's description, contrarily, of bioethics mediation. a consensus-building process, inclusive and empowering. Identity of the service provider would be, from our standpoint, a qualified, effective, experienced mediator, wherever that mediator may come from, be it an independent, a member of the ethics committee, somebody dispatched by the ethics committee. We don't care particularly about that issue of sourcing, but we do care about the effectiveness of that party in conducting clinical mediation. Obstacles to implementation. Who should request? We know. Should be anybody, any party, who would have an interest in the issue that the mediation is being requested to apply to. Now, this is just a little tiny slide that she made up that opens up doors to some of the most important areas of inquiry with regard to this issue of the distinction between healthcare setting for mediation and a traditional mediation setting. And I'm going to start by talking about the hospital ethics committees some more. When the New Jersey Supreme Court rendered its opinion in the Karen Ann Quinlan case, as part of that opinion, although from a strictly legal standpoint, we wouldn't say that this was the holding of the case, but rather what we call dicta, which is probably non-binding, but it is nonetheless a statement made by the writer of the majority opinion, which is being asked to be treated seriously, even if it is not binding on future individuals in other cases. What the Chief Justice said in that opinion was that hospitals better get their act together and create forums for dealing with situations like end of life problems, which obviously the Quinlan matter. Are we okay there, Katrina?
No, it suddenly stopped.
Good word.
Oh, awesome.
Might be a minute.
Okay. Should I keep talking?
Yeah.
Okay. So, in the wake of that decision, imploring hospitals to basically deal with a problem that the court found to be very subject matter specific and suited to being dealt with by professionals in that context of the hospital. The fact is that hospital ethics committees proliferated to the point where they are virtually universal, as many of you know. And the question becomes, what hath the court wrought? Because obviously they had only the best of intentions in recommending that the medical profession take these matters into their own hands, rather than bringing each of these problems on an individual ad hoc basis to a court who is really in no position to make that decision. In fact, it was interesting to me because I don't know if any of you saw the Fred Friendly debate series in which Art Kaplan was one of the panelists and Justice Breyer was on his part of the panel. And it was about, actually in that case, mental health and the way individuals who are not hospitalized get dealt with in this culture. And in effect, what Justice Breyer said was, well, I hope you're not going to court, because let me tell you, they don't know anything about what to do in that situation, which again is what the New Jersey Supreme Court was intimating. The problem is what happened in the evolution of hospital ethics committees. Here's what happened. Imagine St. Francis Hospital. Let's use our pals at St. Francis Hospital. We're going to form our hospital ethics committee. Who do we want on it? I don't know. What do you think about Richard? Yeah, he's a good guy, and he's pretty intelligent. Let's bring him on. Well, we ought to have a doctor. Let's bring Nicole on, all right, or a soon-to-be doctor. Are you a doctor or a soon-to-be?
May,
very soon. So Nicole,
I passed up too.
That's great. Let's bring a chaplain on. Let's bring this bird. Now, okay, that's interesting. Well, you've got this sort of cross-section of views, but what do these people know about providing an ethics consultation? Not even broaching the subject of mediation, but even a classical, in the Nancy Dubler view, classical bioethics consultation, how do you know that they're competent to do this? Well, the answer is no tests, no training uniquely required, no credentialing, none of those things. And so each and every hospital ethics committee more or less stands on its own. Maybe the people are good at it, maybe they're trained, maybe they're not trained. Almost 0%, I think 4%, actually have any training at all in the specifics of bioethics consultation. And then you think that that was a problem, but then you ask, well, when hospital ethics committees are being called in an individual clinical case, how do they render a determination? How do they do their work? Nobody knows. Say, well, now let's go as Fox did and find out. Well, some of them actually come in as a group and they meet and they look at the material that's presented and they vote. They make usually a recommendation, not a range of options, a recommendation that becomes sort of the de facto institutional point of view, and therefore, while not maybe legally binding, it has power, tremendous power in situ. Yes.
What kind of strikes me about that is how, in the term medical consult, like in the hospital, when you order a consult, you might like call in the kidney doctors to kind of render a singular decision and recommendation on what to
do
about the patient's kidney status. And it sounds like the hospital ethics committee is doing a similar thing with the ethical situation.
I think that's a very good analogy. Another way of putting it is they're invoking a juridical model, as some of the literature explains, because there's this presumption that there are those, and in this case we don't even know, even if it were theoretically true, that there are those people out there seized of the capacity to render these judgments. Are these the right ones, number one? And number two, even if they come as manna from heaven, what is it that's going to let us know that they have that unique capacity? Because in fact, if we measure that capacity by degrees and by courses taken and by other external indicia, that tells us nothing about what these people will actually be able to do in that clinical setting to help these people, which is what, in fact, they're there for. And let me tell you what I think is the most incredible anomaly of all. We go and ask some of these hospital ethics committees, what's your decision-making rule? And they say, well, we vote, but it's a majority. Say, my answer to that is, what in the hell is the ethical status of your minority group? Obviously, you must have an ethics committee in which the one-third that's in the minority are unethical. I mean, it's sort of it's so absurd that it is almost like if you could translate this into Saturday Night Live form, this would be the way it would play out. Now, it gets worse.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you know the joke, it's a Woody Allen joke where he's being asked how the food is in a particular hotel, and he says, terrible, but the portions are very small, right? Guess what? Nobody goes to ethics committees. In other words, everything they do, and again, I'm not casting aspersions on individual institutions or hospital ethics committee members. I am talking about the supportable data nationally over a range of all different kinds of hospitals. And what I'm saying is that with all of these flaws that might make you very suspect of getting a clinical ethics consultation from a HEC, can shorten this now to a HEC, guess what? People don't get many. And that's sort of anomalous too, because we all know that there's widespread agreement that disputes in clinical setting they're voluminous. They exist in all hospitals all the time. So the idea that we have built this structure, if you will, pursuant to the recommendation of the court in the Quinlan case, then becomes universal, but A, doesn't address the majority of the problems that are out there, and when it does it irrationally, is quite a quandary. And in fact, bioethicists and people in the healthcare system, post the Fox report, have begun to become a little embarrassed, as well as panicked, at the fact that there may well be a ton of incompetent people out there being dispatched to the bedside for these things. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Bridge.
Yeah, I have to say I was really shocked when Autumn's piece, just that four-page reading that was assigned about
right.
The Fox report, never heard about it at all, et cetera, that kind of thing is going on, and that not only is bioethics consultation going on, but that it's actually not going on to the extent that I thought we had this great thing. Like, ethics committees were, mm-hmm. I had a lot of faith in them, not knowing clearly enough
sure.
about them. And the fact that, like, 15% of, I can't remember exactly what they said, but like 15 cases a year at a hospital with over 500 beds or something.
Yes,
on
that's
average,
not unusual to have that kind of minute
yeah,
fraction.
Yeah, I had a feeling that they were meeting on a much more frequent basis and that things were constantly.
Let me help with that, and I'll get Lisa's question.
Okay.
They do, but remember that hospital ethics committees don't only do individual clinical, don't only deal with insinuating themselves into clinical cases. They have a more omnibus role, mm-hmm. policy issues, stuff regarding the ethics of doing experimentation within the hospital context and so on. So they can meet endless numbers of times without necessarily addressing clinical conflict. Okay, and I'm sure that sometimes is true. Yes?
I remember reading this in the article. So did they investigate why they're not being consulted more frequently?
Why they're not?
What's the rationale for not being consulted more frequently?
Well, I think that it's pretty well understood that it's a combination of things. Again, the patients don't know that this is open to them. And even if they did know, what they might be likely to find out about the way the ethics committee works is that even in hospitals that are interested in providing interventions in individual clinical cases, many hospital ethics committees do so without any real exposure to the bedside and to input from the patient and the family and or the surrogates. And so consequently what you get is a referral from a physician to answer a specific question that gets answered in a kind of rarefied way in the form of a top-down directive which does little to address the broader needs of both the hospital community and the patient. And I think I can help as well by going on, if I could, Katrina, to the next slide, and talk to you a little bit as bioethics students. You've obviously been familiarized with the bioethics principles, and you know what they are. What I think you don't know is that when you go to a HEC for an intervention in a clinical dispute, very often their recommendation or recommendations, whether singular or plural, will come in a form that's based in an argument that has to do with invoking these principles. Now, that might sound reasonable on the face of it, but I can assure you it's totally unreasonable, and here's why. Then the next slide, Katrina. Ethics consults ordinarily result in a non-binding recommendation that effectively becomes the institutional position. Ethics committee or consultant recommendations are frequently couched in terms of bioethics principles. Ethics committee or consultant recommendations frequently articulate a single right answer when any number of ethically and legally acceptable positions may exist. Next slide, please. Principalism. This is from Clauser and Gert, A Critique of Principalism. And I like this quote very much. Principalism in clinical ethics has been criticized as an inadequate approach to the complex realities of patients and families in crisis whose history, relationships, personalities, value systems, religious convictions, and cultural identities impact decision-making on a case-by-case basis. Katrina, next slide, please. Principalism in clinical ethics has also been criticized as flawed in that bioethics principles, while relevant for discussion of these matters, are just chapter headings. They are not concepts that direct you to the answer to any of these clinical dilemmas that are posed. They're sort of subjects to be discussed. But none of those subjects, even if discussed ad infinitum, contain the possibility of yielding the solution to a clinical problem. Bioethics principles cannot yield specific answers, in part because they often reflect competing considerations. Mm-hmm. And there again is the essence of the quandary and why this is an absurd proposition. Because if I say to you, to the Dr. Smith, doctor, I want you to spare my father the pain and indignity that comes with continuing his artificial life support, because he would never have countenanced that. And I think it's demeaning and repugnant to us as a family. And then my brother comes in and says, I want you to respect the fact that it is medicine's, mandate to do everything within its power to help the patient. Beneficence. Where's a clash between beneficence and non-maleficence? Just as there could be a clash between patient autonomy and beneficence, or patient autonomy and non-maleficence. It's the very nature of these principles that they are there to be discussed. When I said that they're chapter headings or subjects for discussion, I wasn't mocking them. What I mean is they only have the capacity to be subjected to a dialogue and balanced in any given case they can be subject to differing perspectives as to what would be an appropriate balance in any given fact situation. They don't tell you where to end up. So the idea that this non-specifically trained, non-credentialed group with no known requirement for decision making reaches resolutions that are that may be taken without the input from the families and the patients, and then frames an outcome that is mandated in the form of bioethics principles is about as inapposite as you can get to trying to address the real crises that people are in when in fact they need this intervention in the first place. Next slide, please, Katrina. Now, I don't want to make this too obscure, but this is important, and I'll just give it to you the way I see it. There are nomenclature problems here as well. Bioethics mediation, you know, is the term that's used at the title of Nancy Dubler and Carol Liebman's book. And it's the term that is more used than any other to talk about the kind of mediation that we're studying in this class. The problem is that it's very misleading. And the reason it's misleading is, as I may have alluded to in earlier classes, most of the problems that develop into conflicts in the clinical setting are not really generated, nor do they derive from, ethical concerns, as we ordinarily think of something that rises to the level of a moral or ethical dilemma. Meaning, if I get asked to come in and help a patient and physician deal with a conflict in which the patient has misunderstood what Dr. X said, or the patient feels hurt or dismissed by Dr. X because of the tone or behavior in which Dr. X has engaged, or because Dr. X and the patient come from very different cultures, and as we've discussed a week ago, are having a clash as a function of the difficulties in each understanding the other's cultural foundations. Are these ethical problems in the sense that normally we talk about ethics in the master's program? Not really, not really. They're communication-based problems. They're personality-based problems. And they're culture-based problems. And guess what? Not surprisingly, mediation, the way we talked about mediation and learned about it last week, works just fine in those situations. And but for some of the other distinctions we're going to see in a few minutes that are not insignificant, but are not at the core of the problems in doing mediation in a clinical setting, are not here in those. So I can't assign a percentage, but let me just say to you, let's suppose, as I think most people would state, that over 50%, whether it's 60, 70, or 80, there's going to be a difference of opinion. But I would say that most people would agree that over 50% of all conflicts in a mediated context stem from communication, personality, or culture-based. Mm-hmm. Issues. Well, then, right off the bat, we have two different categories to which we're applying the mediation process. One of which is, in fact, a specialized area, perhaps not unique to clinical healthcare context, but very emblematic of the clinical healthcare context. And those are the kinds of conflicts that Autumn refers to as the morally aporetic conflicts. Go into that in a minute. But I want to stay with the nomenclature problem for a second. So we call our courses here as you know, not bioethics mediation. We use all different kinds of language. We say challenging clinical ethics, mediation of disputes in a healthcare setting or in a clinical context and so forth, because, and we're not going to rewrite the literature. I think it's too late to usurp the term bioethics mediation, but if we were starting over again and we wanted to apply what we're doing to the larger universe of conflicts in a healthcare setting, I would not use bioethics mediation. I would use mediation of disputes, healthcare disputes, in a clinical context to distinguish those that are not really bioethical in any traditional sense of the word. Now, this, you'll see that this has important ramifications. Now, the next slide, please, Katrina. So, some of the ramifications involve what ultimately do become the obstacles for the widespread adoption of healthcare mediation for reasons we're going to get into right now. The National Working Group for Training and Credentialing in Clinical Ethics, of which I was a member, it was convened in order to produce a white paper in the Hastings Report that addressed this. In fact, the title of the article was called Charting the Future, and it gave a blueprint, if you will, for a future notion of how to train and credential clinical ethics consultants. There's a little bit of an anomaly, though. Now, I signed off on this thing with real reservations, because embedded in that document, and in my view also embedded in the core competencies from the ASBH, which some of you I'm sure are familiar with, I don't know if you all are, is this schizophrenic sense of how they're dealing with what they're calling clinical ethics consultation. The way I read all of these documents, they in effect conclude that mediation is and should be the primary, not is, it should be the primary delivery system for a qualitative ethics, clinical ethics consultation. But by leaving the notion that what we're talking about is clinical ethics consultation, of which mediation is a subset, it leaves open the ability to sustain the current status quo, which is, I am a clinical ethics consultant. These documents tell me that while part of my skill set should include my ability to function effectively as a mediator, they put that in a context of my need to be steeped in the bioethics literature as well as the language of medicine. But it's put in such a way that at least I interpret it to mean that fundamentally what you do is you take a bioethicist and you give them a little bit of supplemental mediation education, and then magically they become a clinical healthcare mediator. Now, that's kind of tough for me to get my arms around, because as somebody who's been doing this, the mediation part of dispute resolution for 21 years, and knowing that every day when I go in there, I'm still on the feeling like I'm a learner. I'm just getting it, I'm getting it down. Just like when somebody practices anything that is a profession and is complex and, infinitely subject to more and more refinement. This idea that you can go and just take a course or even a couple of courses and then get inserted as the hospital's bioethics mediator sounds like another recipe for disaster to me. Although I will acknowledge, in fairness, that I think it is quite possible and also reasonable to think that wide numbers of healthcare professionals, including doctors, but including nurses, social workers, chaplains, and so forth, would be very well off by exposing themselves, as you are, to this material and following through on it to a point where your arsenal of skills for dealing with conflict in a clinical setting is greatly enhanced, although you wouldn't turn around and because of that say, oh, by the way, I'm John Smith, I'm a bioethics mediator, you know, because I took two classes and I did three, cases. You're not gonna do that, right? But what I see here is something that you see in life all the time that's unintended, and that is there's a turf problem. It's turf protection. What if I suddenly say, or we say, to the people who now have the jobs that are designated as clinical ethics consultants, here's the new blueprint for training and credentialing. Unfortunately, John, you've been in the job for 30 years and you've never even broached this subject. All of a sudden, John or Mary or whoever it may be is being placed in a situation where you're telling them, hey, your career is, you know, well into its high point, but you gotta go back and be retrained. And you gotta do it seriously, not as a little side issue. You're gonna actually have to get your hands dirty and commit to this. I don't think that goes down very well. And so even somebody like Nancy Dubler, who, as I just showed you, and this is why I showed you that first slide, she makes the distinction between the consultation and the mediation as starkly as can be. And yet, in her role in that national working group, of which she sort of presided over, she somehow, just like I knuckled under, signed off on a wording and a text that I think walks around the issue, ultimately walks around the issue by not confronting what it would really take to insist that a person who is intervening in a medical crisis be in a position as a function of skill set, training, and experience to actually be someone who you'd feel comfortable saying might be able to help those parties in that problem. And now, as long as that prevails, isn't it also the case that it's not just that the existing clinical ethics consultants are not going to walk away easily or retrain themselves if they're 60 years old, but also when somebody comes from this program and knocks on the door and says, I'd really like to continue my education and my practice of clinical mediation, and that's what I want to do, and I've taken this class, and this class, but I've continued to hone my skills. I volunteered as a mediator here. I did mediations over here. I took more classes. I read more books. I've become engaged in the world of mediation, whether it's in or out of clinical context. If you're really an agent for that change, are they likely to want you there? I know that one of my students went to a to-be-unnamed hospital in Washington, got hired, and only after she started the job was basically told that her real job was to be the fall guy for the institution, the bearer of bad news. In other words, she thought she was going there to be part of the solution. It ended up being that she was the one who would have to spout the institutional position to the unhappy patient or family member, with no ability at all to address the underlying concerns that were there. And it was a very traumatic experience for her. Steve.
I wonder if another issue, another thing that would stop mediation from kind of becoming the standard of care is that doctors and social workers and different members of the hospital team, nurses, maybe already have ways of solving these kind of informal conflicts, and that many doctors feel that they're that is their skill set, that they don't need an additional person on the team to solve these kind of communications, and that the only use of the ethics committee is like for kind of really complicated issues.
Well, that's an excellent point, but and I'll get you in a minute. That's an excellent point, and we're not trying to sell mediation as a cure-all, nor are we saying that you have to institute mediation as a first line, if you will, of intervention in clinical situations where the caregiver, his or her, him or herself, mm-hmm. is in fact capable. It's only when that doesn't resolve the problem that the mediator's skills come into play. Mm-hmm. Yes?
No, I was just going to say, in response to your statement, is I see the kind of care team being used a lot in that instance, where they're pulled in early, mm-hmm. and when there's decision making about end of life or complex care needs for the pediatric setting,
sure.
they will be pulled in. Now, whether they're appropriately trained or not is another issue, but mm-hmm. they're typically brought in, and they do a lot of that discussion. With all the teams.
Absolutely. And I hasten to add that if you were to read, I think I assigned at least a chapter or two in the book, Breaking the Deadlock or
Getting
DS? No, Breaking the Deadlock or Breaking the Impasse. Mm-hmm. In any event, you will see in your materials that I gave you a book, which is not in and of itself something that addresses mediation, but addresses the dynamics of conflict between caregivers and patients. To the extent that caregivers become expert in dealing with the kind of shared responsibility model of caregiving that is now currently expected of healthcare professionals, and understand collaboration and negotiation as the essence of the patient-caregiver relationship, that will diminish the need for mediation intervention, but it will never erase it, because there are always going to be situations that can't get solved at the level of caregiver-patient only, for reasons that you'll see in a minute, but that's a great statement. Okay, so where are we? The nomenclature. What they're saying is, what we do is we include in this notion of clinical ethics consultants a process where recommendations are made. And the way they soften it is to sort of say, well, you only make the recommendation when the patient or the caregiver requests it. In other words, you don't foist it upon them, but if they say to you, we need your help and I don't know how to do this. Now, there are, in fact, situations in which patients are not emotionally equipped to deal with certain levels of crisis and affirmatively wish to delegate that function to somebody else. So what they're saying is they're trying to define the consultative versus the mediative function as being more connected to situations where the patient or the caregiver is making the request, and they're softening it further by recommending that these consultants give recommendations that incorporate the values of shared decision making. and inclusiveness and diversity in value systems. It's all very well and good, but I defy anybody to tell me how it is that you're going to be able to bring about that result as a function of just putting those words out there. You're either going to follow the model, make it be a model that's integrated and internalized within the healthcare system as the way of dealing with conflict in the clinic, or you're going to hang on to this notion. And again, I refer to those of you who've had Autumn's courses. I'm going to go back to the moral aporetic. I don't know whether I did slides on it, but it doesn't matter. Here's the problem. If, as discussed in the issue of operative principles and their balancing, we have a truly morally aporetic situation, the reason that that is unique is because you have competing genuine moral points of view, both of which are being offered, both of which deserve respect, but neither of which is likely to convince the other side to abandon their perspective, which has as much moral validity as yours, and simply concede that your position is the one. So what we understand about situations like that is that the notion of resolving conflict in that arena is not a matter of changing people's minds. It's a matter of bringing them to a point of understanding at both an emotional and cognitive level of the contemporary or concurrent existence of valid moral arguments that, even though they're irreconcilable, still require action in the instance of the patient. So you don't need to change my moral stance or my moral values in order for us to arrive at a mutually agreeable outcome that is consensual, again, meaning consensual is better in our collective view than the alternatives. Now, what happens when we have a morally aporetic conflict in a clinical setting is that if we don't resolve it as to action, as to decision, not as to morality, as to action, what happens? Somebody is empowered to make the decision for us. The point of attempting a consensual mediated resolution is to maintain the power of those most interested parties, patients, physicians, nurses, sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, so that they have the power to create a resolution that, even though it's not their first best choice, it's something that they would prefer to ceding authority to whomever under the law is empowered to make that decision, be it a surrogate, a particular physician, a court, or whatever. Because you don't always resolve the problem, but if you don't resolve the problem, there are consequences. And the problem is that once parties, not the problem, the good news is that once parties recognize that the very nature of a morally aporetic dilemma is that one cannot with certainty predict, if you say A and you say B, and it's truly a matter of you contending for one valid moral position versus another, none of us can say with certainty that choice A or choice B will be the right choice going forward. We don't have that power. We only can say what we believe is the right choice. once you truly understand, and mediators, if they're effective, can actually help this to be created, you understand that fact. You understand that what's being said by party A is not some kind of knee-jerk crazy thing that has no basis in, not no basis, in fact, has no basis in being argued as morally valid. And you understand that it does have moral validity and that it can't be proved that it's wrong any more than your position can be proved to be right. That sets the stage tonally and emotionally for people to make a pragmatic solution to the problem, because the level of their dispute, the intensity of their dispute, will in the right circumstances become muted by this mutual understanding and validation of one another's points of view. It sounds very highfalutin, but when you actually see it in practice and when it works, it's a remarkable thing. And it actually brings people not only closer together, but it sort of reaffirms people's faith in human nature and in the shared dilemma we all confront of being flawed human beings in an imperfect world. It sort of takes you to a new level of recognition of what it means to have a real problem. Because that is a real problem. Okay? Now, next slide. So, here's my question. Why mediation? Today, experts who study the medical interview generally agree that a negotiated approach best describes what actually happens between physician and patient and is more likely to produce satisfaction for both parties and great patient adherence to the treatment plan. That's from Aaron Lazar on Apology. Lazar, I believe, was the dean of University of Massachusetts Medical School. Next slide. So now I'm going to show you some instances in the recent literature that support this notion that I'm espousing, which is that the modern view, the respected contemporary view of the nature of the physician-patient relationship as a negotiation is now widely held. So I start with Groupman, Jerome Groupman. Some of you have probably read How Doctors Think. If you haven't, I definitely recommend it. Groupman describes, interestingly, in his book, what he says is an optimal approach to clinical diagnostics. And lo and behold, what does he put in his, I don't know if they were his bullet points or mine, but in any event, they're his thoughts. Hearing the patient's story in her own words. And then you notice I put down interruptions. So he also footnotes the fact, as some of you may know, that the average time in a physician-patient interaction for the physician to interject and interrupt what the patient is saying is 18 seconds.
No, it's 13 seconds.
13 seconds, right. I was actually debating in my mind whether I was misremembering it. Thank you. 13 seconds. Not a very long period of time.
It's 18 in Groupman. But.
Yeah, that's right, 18 would be fine. So Groupman,
either way,
his first concept
15 seconds
is
to argue about it.
You gotta hear her story in her words, uninterrupted. You have to build rapport. Wow, didn't we hear that someplace else? We have to acknowledge the other party. I think we heard that one before. You have to use open-ended questions. Where have we seen that? What a new idea. And we have to listen actively. What a shocker, right? It was as though he took the first part of the course. He didn't. But he knows from long experience that these are absolutely critical aspects of being able to understand what is going on in a physician-patient dialogue. And he attributes the cause of most diagnostic errors, and again, you know, we have the 13-second thing. We also know that the literature shows that in autopsy reports, 15% of all cases that are ultimately result in death are misdiagnosed. When we do the autopsy, we find that the attributed cause of death was absolutely incorrect, which is scary. But he attributes that not to deficiencies in medical knowledge and skills, but to what he calls cognitive traps, which we don't have time to go into all of his examples of cognitive traps, but a lot of them inhere in these notions and thwarting those notions instead of enabling them to come to fruition. Next slide. And Louis Dubertre, in 2006, wrote this about the optimal physician-patient relationship. First, the physician poses questions to the patient to elicit information about the patient's illness. Second, the physician explains the illness to the patient. Third, the physician and the patient engage in therapeutic negotiation. And four, the physician issues a prescription or a contract that concludes negotiations. Very clearly, the physician-patient relationship described based on, predicated on a negotiation model. And number, next slide, Katrina. We have Pauline Chen writing Final Exam in 2007. Lo and behold, she cites six important medical interview techniques. Ask open-ended questions, listen, look at your patient, don't talk at your patient, ask them why they came in to see you, figure out how they perceive their medical problems. Doesn't this look suspiciously like finding out the underlying interests of the party, the patient party? So the take-home lesson attributed to a lecturer described in the book was, quote, you'll be a better doctor if you can stand in your patient's shoes. Next slide. Negotiation-based approaches to the physician-patient relationship embrace a shift in emphasis from the physician as expert model to the physician as collaborator or shared decision-making model. I alluded to the breaking the impasse or whatever and recommend it to you at the place where it's assigned. But again, as is evident from the phrases, what we're distinguishing here is the old notion of a party going to the doctor who is omniscient as to all things even vaguely related to one's care and well-being. Go in, present yourself to the doctor who tells you what to do, doesn't ask you what you need, tells you what to do by examining you and perhaps asking some perfunctory questions, which are going to be, the answers to which are going to be interrupted. And then tells you what's going to happen, and that's the end of it. And that was widely accepted by most people as what you did when you went to see the doctor. But in contemporary life, as a function of many things, remember when that used to happen, we didn't have a consumer rights movement. We didn't have a patient's rights movement. We didn't have a civil rights movement. And we didn't have the internet. We didn't have any of this stuff. So it was very easy to perpetuate that. And we also lived in a completely different world. There weren't many women physicians out there, were there? And there certainly weren't many minority physicians out there. And it was a whole different world that could count on the acceptance of that kind of ethos, which is no longer acceptable. Can I have the next slide? Yeah, Richard.
But all this actually was published 2,700 years ago. This comes directly out of the aphorisms.
Absolutely does. You're
this
right.
It's classic Hippocratic medicine.
It's classic Hippocratic medicine, and I wasn't going to talk about it today, but I think that I have it on your syllabus for maybe next week. But, you know, it goes back to Greek philosophy and to Greek tragedy and Greek comedy. But I think we'll touch on that next week. But I'm glad you mentioned that, and you're right, spot on. You're spot on. I don't need this, Katrina. The next slide, please. So here's my hypothesis. Mediation, we know, is a form of assisted negotiation. If the ideal physician-patient relationship is based on a negotiation model, mediation should be the mechanism of choice for resolving disputes stemming from an unassisted negotiation that has broken down and is incapable of resolution by the parties alone. It just flows absolutely naturally that that would be the case. We're talking about agreeing that it's a negotiation model. We know that negotiation unassisted is what occurs in the first instance. We're stating the premise that that unassisted negotiation, which came to fruition at some point, went off the rails. And now we need a way of reconstructing or reconstituting it. Wouldn't you turn to assisted negotiation if in fact you need assistance with what has broken? Next slide. I also, by the way, want to say, I don't have slides for it, but I've recently, in writing a chapter for a Japanese textbook on clinical ethics, and I've just incorporated in there, in addition to what Richard was mentioning about classical antecedents, the literature on bioethics mediation doesn't talk about it, but there is also a real affinity between the notion of clinical mediation and the world of what's called narrative medical ethics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, although nobody says it, I think if you read narrative medical ethicists and see that among their conclusions are that it is the patient herself who is the ethicist, not the outside consultant. And if you accept their notion that it is the telling of the whole story and its various iterations that gives rise to conclusions, not the imposition in a juridical model by third parties who purport to know what the right answer is, but in fact can't really tell us how they come to divine that information. And at the end of the day, you can say, I divine it because I wrote this article, I divine it because I read these 3,000 books, I divine it because I have this degree, pardon my expression, bullshit. Not true. That expertise that they're talking about is inapposite to moral expertise, which, again, we'll talk about next week how the people of ancient times would have formulated what the source is for the moral knowledge. But it is not this kind of extrinsic, self-appointed knowledge and expertise that comes from books. Now I want to talk about what I'm calling characteristics of the mediation of clinical disputes. And again, this is meaning the distinctions that we run across in clinical versus traditional mediations. And I don't want this slide, Katrina. I'd like the next one. Now, first is the question of neutrality. Now, this is a very elusive, very tough question to fully understand in the context of clinical mediation. First of all, there are many tiers of neutrality, not E-A-R-S, I-E-R-S, that we have to address. And the first and most easily graspable one is, and I think we touched on this maybe for a second, is that I'm a mediator, HUP hires me as their mediator, Katie is a patient at HUP, Richard is the doctor, they have a dispute, they call me in, Katie looks at me and says, well, who are you? Well, I'm Ed Bergman, I'm the director of the HUP mediation program. Oh, that's interesting, so you work for the hospital? Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Oh, and so they pay you, right? Yes, they do. And I guess you've seen Dr. Whittington before, he works here, and since you work here, you've probably seen him. Yes, I have. Well, I don't want you to be my mediator, right? Okay, now, that is a problem in the following sense. In traditional mediation context, in the law, or in generally in business disputes, that kind of compromise, if you will, would in fact be seen not necessarily as a de facto attack on your neutrality, but it would be seen as certainly something that would create perceived lack of neutrality on your part and would generally result in your being recused as the neutral in any given case. The problem is that when you talk about mediation in a clinical setting, it has been very difficult for us to be able to fashion a model that seems as though it would be economically viable without having it be the case that the hospital is essentially the payor. In fact, when I first came to the Center for Bioethics, and Art Kaplan and Autumn Feaster and I began to deal with this issue, actually, our position 7 years ago was we wanted to hold out for independent mediators only and not mediators that were employed by the hospital. It became clear that that was not going to be feasible because a skilled, experienced mediator, healthcare or otherwise, with the kind of skills and training we've been talking about, is not going to be able to come to your hospital charging what the hourly rate that would be necessary for the amount of training and experience they have and could command in other sectors, and still make it viable for mediation to be widely adopted in the clinical setting. It's obviously much more plausible to have an employee who is paid a salary who does, during the course of their employment, either 100%, 75%, 50% mediation as part of his or her duties, is more viable, not to mention the fact that you also have logistical problems when the mediator is being sought from a place that's not within the hospital itself. What we've found as a practical matter, in particular from Nancy Dubler's experience and her colleagues' experience at Montefiore Medical Center in New York, where their program has existed for a long time, that by and large, people do not have a problem with this if, in fact, the mediator presents herself in a way that is perceived by the disputants, including the family and patients, as in fact impartial. Not, in other words, looking past the appearance of lack of neutrality to the fact of neutrality, if in fact that mediator is skilled enough to present themselves in that way, it has caused incredibly little problem. So that's very interesting, number one. And number two, there's perhaps an underlying explanation for it, which is if the patient understands that the reason the hospital hired a mediator and created a mediation program was not to bring about a particular result in a given case, but rather because affording the opportunity to all people who are in the hospital setting to have the opportunity to create this morally protected space in which people felt comfortable, heard, acknowledged, empowered, etc., their reaction to the hospital experience would be more positive. And that the hospital's interest in putting Nancy there wasn't to get their point of view across in the dispute between Katze and Dr. Smith, but rather to make sure that people understood that this hospital cares about the way the patients and their families and their surrogates feel, and cares about the fact that there's a forum to which they can go in order to raise these difficult, critical disputes. So again, is it a perfect answer? Probably not, but are we gonna have to live with it? Probably. I mean, the only alternative that I could see would obviously involve a major political initiative in which the government would, in effect, say, this has to be integrated into the general healthcare provider model, and there somehow will be a single provider way, through whatever means, of making sure that all caregivers and patients, and that seems, as we know, pretty remote. So I think as a practical matter, in most cases, this is probably what we're looking at as a likely model for the next phase in the adoption of clinical mediation. Now, unfortunately, neutrality in clinical mediation is a much harder problem than that. That's the easy one. Here's the hard one. When the traditionalists argue that the reason they don't countenance mediation for the resolution of clinical disputes is because, and this is a quote, that it takes the ethics out of ethics consultation. That is their shorthand for what I spent about a half an hour explaining the sort of incomprehensible circular argument that they make is, meaning what they're saying is there's a hypothesis that there are people out there who have access to superior moral knowledge. And what they're saying is if you mediate and you reach a consensual resolution, there's nobody who is going to monitor whether that consensual resolution is really morally and ethically sound. Mm-hmm. But you see, the gap that is involved conceptually here is so vast because it's based on a completely different understanding of the world. Meaning, if you believe there's somebody out there who can tell you what is the right thing to pull the plug on Dad, or not, or whether to, you know, initiate or remove treatment. If there's somebody out there who purports to have and can prove that they have such superior medical knowledge, then that would be ethical knowledge. That would be taking the ethics out of clinical ethics. But poof, there is no such person, and there is no such. There's no argument that really supports intellectually that notion at all, not at all. And what I said, well, here is something that Nancy says, and I'll give you some other formulations. In the mediation of clinical disputes, neutrality equals respect for the patient, the family, and the care providers, and an impartial stance regarding what should be the outcome in any particular case. But again, she's tripping on her own shoelaces. Even Nancy even Nancy, tripping on her own shoelaces because, first of all, the notion of the distinction that we talked about, that she makes between the consultation and the mediation, presupposes that in the mediation, the resolution that is consensual is not going to be dictated from any set of extrinsic norms, meaning there's no codified body of knowledge to which one can refer that gives you the answer. Now, she rightly says and is confounded by, what do we do as mediators if in fact, and this is not going to happen very frequently, doctor and patient agree on an outcome that is illegal? There, I think, there is a point in which it's true that this so-called neutral can be said to be imperfectly neutral because she is applying to some degree external norms for the acceptability of the outcome. But guess what? That's true in certain other kinds of non-medical, non-clinical mediations. Meaning there's a difference between fashioning a consensual resolution which in a civil commercial matter in which the parties behave in a way that accords each of them a different set of rights than they would get if they litigated their issue to the mat and got a ruling from a judge or jury. Meaning they don't have to, in creating their resolution, follow the extrinsic norm that the court would follow in making an either or right or wrong decision, winner, loser. But we're not talking winner, loser here. And we're only concerned not about the mechanism for getting there, but whether the outcome is truly unlawful prospectively, meaning Dr. Steve and Katie agree to a resolution which countenances and anticipates physician-assisted suicide in a state that prohibits it. But that could happen in a non-clinical mediation, and the answer for me there as a mediator, and for you, I would hope, would be, among other things, I did not give up my own moral standing when I became a mediator, and I will not countenance and be a part of a process, manage a process that's going to yield this unlawful outcome. Hence, I will recuse myself, and I will not be part of that. And if they reach that conclusion, and they are brought to, you know, brought to legal accounting for it, it is certainly not my problem because I've let them know that this isn't something I can countenance. But you see, the problem is that that's not where the real confusion lies. The confusion lies in what they are still harboring in the traditional mindset, is an ethical mandate. Not a legal mandate, an ethical mandate that somehow Steve and Katie are going to come to a resolution that is perfectly lawful, but which Mr. Mediator Know-It-All is going to be able to say, oh no, you can't do that. Why? It's unethical. First of all, even if that were conceptually possible, the very idea of mediation and the very idea of the fact that there are representatives of the two conflicting sides that are entering into this dialogue does not make it very likely that they're going to come up with a resolution that is willfully unethical, because they are counterbalancing themselves, that they're engaged in striking a balance. And the mediator is there to help them through the thicket, which doesn't have to be done by saying to them, by the way, you can't do this, you must do this, but rather asking them to seriously consider in their own minds and hearts, is this something that resonates with me, Katie, with me, Steve, as something that I can live with as morally defensible and within the parameters of the law? I think it would be very hard to make an argument, and I've yet to see it, where you can show me that such an outcome would be able to be discarded or treated as inappropriate because it is ethically indefensible. But we have already seen, by defining this universe of moral aporia, that in fact the whole idea of such a conflict is that it is morally defensible. Yeah, Dave.
Just going back to the legal aspect, and I know this is a minor part of what you were talking about, but I question somewhat the practicality of recusing yourself from an illegal decision, such
Why is
as
that?
If a physician and a patient come to the decision that the physician is going to assist in suicide, for example,
right?
Just that's what comes to my mind, and you are a part to this decision, but you recuse yourself from the decision, would you then not be obligated to report the
right.
fact that they're going to take this action?
That is a separate and important question. Under mediation, the Uniform Mediation Act, which many, if not by now most states, have adopted,
okay.
that would probably be an exception to the confidentiality
mm-hmm.
of a mediation communication. And so that is true that in that situation, depending on the laws of the state,
okay.
and this is another reason why this all gets dicey, and we're going to see in a minute, that the two concepts that are most elusive here are neutrality and confidentiality.
I mean, even just ethically, we'll talk about law. The
sure.
act is illegal, but ethically, what would be your viewpoint on your duty at this point?
The reason that the question is a good question and not a no-brainer is that because people who are professional mediators tend to be very dedicated to the notion that one can't mediate effectively without the parties having utter confidence in the fact that what they ask the mediator not to repeat will never be repeated, and that even if the mediator is subpoenaed by a court to come in and say, isn't it true that John Smith said on such and such a day in such an office, X, the privilege of not having to say that, and this is unusual, I don't think it's true of the physician-patient privilege, the mediator privilege runs to the mediator as well as to the participants, the disputants. And so part of my ethical obligation is to protect the ethics of mediation and not violate that notion that these people are telling me this in confidence. However, because of what I'm saying is embraced by the exceptions in the Uniform Mediation Act, my own view would be, I would report that.
I was going to say, just the physician-patient relationship, I'm not sure I totally understood the distinction you made, but you know, we have similar requirements. You know, we're
yes.
supposed to keep everything confidential
right.
except
right.
for, you know, X, Y, Z.
And the same is
know.
True of lawyers. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. again, mediators don't necessarily have to be lawyers, and these guidelines apply to mediators regardless of whether they're lawyers. But yes, in general, there is an exception made for cases in which a felony is about to be committed. But
So you see where, yeah, where I'm going. I don't want to get too deeply into it because it's a never-ending hornet's nest. So let me have the next one, Katrina. So this will help you see why it's so confusing, because I'm giving you statements from different commentators. Bernard Mayer, who wrote a book called Beyond Neutrality, says some commentators have opined that neutrality need not be the exclusive stance of an effective conflict specialist. In this view, mediation and facilitation are a large part, but not all, of the tools of the trade. And here I make a query. Can the mediator be partial as to outcomes when the principled resolution, that's Nancy's term, previously referenced, requires that the mediator reject outcomes which violate the law and or clearly established ethical criteria? And that's where the rub lies. And what I'm saying is I don't see the neutrality of the mediator being significantly challenged by the need to ensure that no laws are violated by the implementation of the mediated outcome. But I do see a problem with this vague notion of clearly established ethical criteria, where nobody is telling me, mm-hmm, and exactly what is that criterion that could not be breached that could not be breached without being called unethical and violative of an acceptable outcome reached by the parties consensually. Yeah, Rich.
As an example, my spouse is an neonatologist, and she's had, I think, twice in her career where she's had parents that basically bought a baby through private adoption,
right,
and it was clear to her for various reasons that the parents were buying the baby weren't fit.
Okay.
And so she was quite upset with this and went to seek guidance. No mediators, got a lawyer instead.
Right.
And one case, the lawyer said you have to call DIFAS, because apparently New Jersey DIFAS does not review private adoptions.
They don't now. Yeah. Oh, I guess maybe they never did. Yeah.
And in the second case, the attorney told her that she had to, that she could not call DIFAS, that she had to just suck it up.
And but how is that the invocation of clearly established ethical criteria?
Well, ethically being the fact that these parents would be considered unfit by any adoption agency to adopt a child. It was fairly clear, although not explicitly stated, that the parents were paying a sum of money to the
right.
biological mother.
But see, if you transpose that scenario to a mediated conflict, what would happen?
Her conflict would be between her and the adoptive parents, with the adoptive parents actually the biological parents on the same side.
Okay.
Because they were willing to accept this, but she felt that it was improper for this adoption to go through.
The question, though, that I would ask you is, she has every right to her ethical imperatives. The question here, though, is a different question. It's whether if you introduce a third party who hears this input, and suppose your wife and Katie reached an accommodation of some kind, whether it was they could adopt or they couldn't adopt, or there was some kind of intervening process that had to occur, what about that would constitute a violation of established ethical criteria?
Well, she felt that she had an ethical obligation to have this looked at and get somebody else outside involved.
But that's what happens in every morally aberrant situation. She has a well-grounded moral objection. These people over here are saying, if there's no law, and I can tell you that I will be a loving, diligent parent, and then bring forth all the criteria. We have the wherewithal, we have the home, we're sending them to school, we're educated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. we can be good parents and provide a wonderful home for this girl.
Well, in one case, DIFAS had already taken children from the home.
But see, there, I think you're turning it around to the merits of the individual presentations, right? Your wife, even if she didn't make her decision based on the particular moral judgment that you just said, would respond to Katie by saying, I can't live with the idea of a prospective parent being somebody who has already been deemed to be abusive of children. Therefore, there would be no mediated outcome.
Well,
because your wife would never agree to it.
Well, she didn't have to agree. That was just it. These were the parents were saying it wasn't any of her business. She didn't have a role. She was just a caregiver for the infant while the infant was hospitalized.
Right.
And she said no, that while she was a caregiver for the infant, she felt she had an obligation to that infant, to the interests of that infant.
Sure.
And therefore, she should do what she could to impede the adoption.
And I think, let me see if I can nail this down. No, this is important. That you're positing a different problem than I am. If I came into that situation at the request of a hospital, or of your wife, or of Katie, and I listened to these various positions and helped try to facilitate a resolution, it would not be incumbent upon either of you to agree to any resolution. And your wife would be entitled to maintain her adherence to that moral principle because it was hers. We would either find out there was a bridge to that outcome, something like, for example, typical one in that kind of case would be, let's have a 6-month period in which we have supervised parenting and a report done by a mental health professional. Submit that to me. And at the end of that 6-month period, based on that, then we'll reconvene the mediation and decide. That's what I mean. Okay, next slide, Katrina. Here, do you guys know Dave Perlman from around here in the center? David is an associate fellow here, and he teaches some mediation classes in the nursing school. But in his doctoral thesis, he incorporated the suggestion that in the context of clinical disputes, an alternative definition of neutrality may be required. Neutrality as to the parties, but not as to outcomes where social norms have been established. I think David is tripping on the same shoelaces again, because certainly neutrality as to the parties is very much what I'm talking about the people at Montefiore Hospital being able to accomplish in their relationships to the patients and family members who are invoking the mediation program's intervention. But what he's saying is going back to the idea that there are norms that have to be applied extrinsic to the mediation that will drive the outcome as being either acceptable or unacceptable. So I don't think that contributes to the resolution. It just restates it. Now, this is more my statement and maybe the center's statement, the last one. We propose that in a clinical context, the mediator, while neutral as to the parties, may be an outspoken advocate for full information exchange, clarity of communication, expression of emotion, procedural fairness, adherence to legal norms, and here's where I would change the formulation, the possible utility of generally accepted ethical principles, meaning just as we discussed when we were talking about non-clinical mediations last week and when we saw the video. It's a different thing for me to say, have you ever thought about, A, or have you read the literature that deals with B? And if there is literature that espouses a contrary position, have you read the literature that espouses that view? Bringing into the moral dialogue these prior attempts at people to discuss, not the identical, because every case is different, but to discuss related issues and help understand and be able to get them into some kind of greater control. There's nothing wrong with considering a hypothetical ethical proposition wherever it's drawn from. But that's a very different thing than saying that Art Kaplan said in this book, thou shalt not allow adoptions for people who had one prior Dreyfus conviction, right? That's a very different thing. But one certainly could say, have you considered the impact on Dr. X of knowing that you have shared with her your prior problem in parenting, as evidenced by this? Is there a way that you might propose that would create a greater comfort level in the mind of Dr. So-and-so? That's a very different thing, isn't it, than telling them what is morally correct. It's trying to help them gain access to all of the perspective and points of view in order to help them manage the problem, because they're managing the problem. They're not solving it. They're not making it go away, but they're trying to manage a process and reach a consensual resolution. Keep going back to that. That's better than the alternatives. Better than the alternatives. Richard, if your wife were in that position, and if these women could have gone to another doctor right down the street and gotten the thing done, then the import of her saying that that's ethically unacceptable to me would not really drive the ultimate outcome. It would only mean that she's not willing to be a party to it. Katrina, can I have the next slide? Oh, here are two other things that I think are even crazier than some of the other suggestions. But I want you to know, as I espouse the virtues of my profession, I also want you to know that as a mediator, I accept the existence of all of these points of view, but simply invite you to decide what does and what doesn't hold water. So here we get a suggestion from Hoffman in a law review article, Mediating Life and Death Decisions. And I ask you, as we read this, A, is this feasible? And B, to what extent is it in direct conflict with the whole concept of mediation? So let's look at number one. It has been suggested that in the context of clinical disputes, the neutrality dilemma might be addressed by having a member of the hospital ethics committee participate as a party to the mediation. Now, the way I read that, that means that the same person who was part of that hospital ethics committee that we just discussed, that operates on the basis that we just discussed, being a party to the mediation and therefore needing to be a part of any consensual resolution, would in effect have veto power over the caregivers, the patient, the family, the surrogates, because they might seek to intervene and say, once again, can't do that. Why? Is it against the law? No.
Well, why can't we do it? It's not ethical. According to whom? According to me. According to generally accepted ethical principles. Show me the principle and apply it here. Show me that there isn't a countervailing, equally valid, generally accepted ethical principle. Then we'll talk. It has been suggested that in the context of clinical disputes, the neutrality dilemma might be addressed with a review of mediated outcomes by the Hospital Ethics Committee. I mean, we can't, first of all, get to the point where we can find a way to fund and implement widespread hospital mediation programs. And here, they're not only saying, let's add another layer to this, which is particularly ironic since at times, as you know, in the most pressing situations, time is of the essence. And these things must be dealt with on an expedited, urgent basis. Now what's going to happen? Every time parties reach a consensual resolution, we're going to have effectively a review process by a hospital ethics committee, which is constituted the way we've learned it's constituted, and which relies on principles that we've learned are inapposite to determining whether the conclusion was right or wrong in the first place. So for me, those are non-starters. But I'll let you reach your own conclusions. And I certainly welcome you to read any of the material that is source material for some of these slides that I prepared. Can I have another slide, Katrina? Again, we're talking about distinguishing characteristics of clinical disputes. Obviously, they can involve life and death issues. Most legal and business mediations and conflicts don't. In the mediation of clinical disputes, facts play a different role. Now, I think this is a reasonable point and should be considered. Nancy Dubler indicates that in classical mediation, agreement on the facts may not be necessary. In the mediation of clinical disputes, the objective medical facts must be ascertained even where the parties disagree on the interpretation of those facts. And I think that's true. We can literally have any kind of commercial dispute, and we can go right to the question of a solution, whether it's a monetary solution or some other behavioral solution, with absolutely no agreement on what the underlying facts are. Because if people are willing to do that and make that leap, so be it. If the mediation reaches a consensual outcome, if the parties agree that they're fully informed, and in those cases they're very often going to have the assistance of legal counsel as well, and they can do that, fine. But in a clinical mediation involving medical facts, we've got to know what those facts are in order to take the mediation to the next stage. The person with the greatest stake in the dispute, the patient, is often not at the table. Clearly, in clinical mediations, you have a very large number of situations in which either the patient is incompetent or literally unconscious and cannot participate for either of those reasons in the mediation. Now, at first, that seems unique to healthcare mediation. But in fact, I'm not quite sure why the literature doesn't quite note that in many mediations outside of the clinic, as you guys have already learned, parties are negotiating through agents. And after all, who are these surrogates? They're agents, right? And that the problem is not that it's only in clinical context that the party in interest is not at the table. The problem is that A, there is an inordinate number of instances, number one, in which the patient is not at the table. And number two, in the non-clinical context where the party in interest is not at the table, two things can usually happen. Elizabeth is using an agent, Steve. Steve goes to the table, Elizabeth isn't present. Steve starts the negotiation. He gets confused with their prior conversation about what position she wanted him to articulate. He gets on the phone. Hey, Elizabeth, I got a problem here. This has come up, and I'm not really sure where you want to go on this issue. So he can consult her. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, you can't consult the unconscious mm-hmm. or incompetent yeah. patient. Mm-hmm. Also, there are many times in classical mediations where the client, either in writing or simply orally, has simply said to that agent, usually a lawyer, you have full authority to act on my behalf. And so that lawyer knows, sitting at that table, that even without going back and calling Elizabeth, he can make that decision. Now, she may not like it, but he is acting within the scope of his authority. Here, in the clinical context, you do have an analog, but it looks very different. Where does that authority come from in the clinical context? Anybody? How does that?
Advanced directive?
Advanced directive, sure. So there's a living will or a durable medical power of attorney that makes you the guy to step up to the plate. Now, in the case of the medical power of attorney and the living will, if in fact the surrogate is explicitly named and given authority to make all decisions on the part of the now incompetent or unconscious patient, he has the same authority as the attorney who got power of attorney or full authority from his client. But there is also the alternative of him being there not based on an advance directive, but based on a statute of the state that describes who makes decisions for that incompetent or unconscious party if there is no prior naming of the surrogate by the advance directive. Some of those statutes simply say the order in which you get to step up to the plate, meaning spouse, child, parent, etc., etc. Other states have statutes that will articulate the criteria that the statutorily designated surrogate must utilize in applying his or her surrogacy responsibilities. Therefore, again, understanding that mediation involves these consensual resolutions in which if we don't get it done, somebody's going to decide. A good mediator, an effective mediator in this kind of clinical context is probably going to want to incorporate within that moral dialogue the issue of what considerations will be brought to bear on the decision by who in the event no consensual resolution is reached. Okay? It's a little complicated, but I think that really gives you the entire spectrum of the principal-agent relationship as it applies in the clinical context. Anybody have any questions about that? Is that issue? But the thing that I want to make sure you understand is that when in some of this literature, it's kind of like when it says in, I think that's really in the Dubla book, the person with the greatest stake in the dispute, the patient is often not at the table, and just leave it at that. That sort of kind of doesn't address the fact that it is not that dissimilar from what happens outside the clinical context with certain modifications as a function of what we just discussed. Come to the next slide. Absent evidence to the contrary, and this is very important, all parties are committed to the best interest of the patient. Now, typically, when I'm mediating non-clinical disputes in court-connected or privately, the parties come into the room believing, genuinely believing, that their respective interests are adverse to one another. Now, we've learned when we talked about integrative negotiation that sometimes we can, through mediation, help disabuse people of the extent of their adversarial positions by finding underlying interests that are compatible or shared. But leaving that aside for the moment, regardless of whether you're a mother, a father, a child, a friend, a lover, a surgeon, a nurse, a chaplain, whatever, involved in this clinical mediation, unless you have some hidden agenda, which, by the way, is pretty well suited to being revealed in mediation because of the nature of the mediation process and the eliciting of information from the various parties, you are presumed to have the same interests that I do, which is the welfare of Johnny. The doctor cares about Johnny, ostensibly. Now, if we find out that the doctor has, in the last 6 months, been found to be drinking on the job and no longer capable of implementing his desire to make Johnny better, well, that's a different story. But the doctor is otherwise, if we don't find something like that out, is committed to Johnny's best interest. But so is Johnny's daughter, unless we find out that Johnny's daughter wants to pull the plug because he needs the money to pay the gambling debt, right? And although mediation is not a panacea, and it isn't a perfect way of getting every single piece of information out, it's about as good as it gets, or is gonna get. But in terms of defining distinguishing characteristics of clinical conflict and clinical mediation, I think that's a very useful one, which is that we start with the presumption that everybody has the best interests of the patient at heart, and only reach an alternative conclusion when, in fact, we have learned something that opposes that other reality. Most clinical conflicts are multi-party events. That's true. They're not all multi-party events, but generally they're going to involve some complex of doctors, nurses, pastoral care, the patient, a spouse, children, lovers, and so forth, but not always. And in other kinds of non-clinical mediations, depending on the type of mediation, there are also mostly multi-party events. It's not unique to clinical. It's just one of those areas in which multi-party mediations are common. And we learned, did we not, how much more complicated it is to deal with multi-party, multi-issue negotiations for all the reasons that we've already explored. The parties don't ordinarily sign an agreement to mediate. Now, that's a little misleading too. It's true that they don't. But it's also true that in mediations that are court-connected, meaning where the court refers the parties to mediation, they don't sign an agreement to mediate. The judge signs an order of referral to mediation. It's very rare that you're going to find in a clinical context any documents associated with the formalities of mediation.
There may be some exceptions to that of the following type. At Drexel Medical School, and this pertains really more in the area of medical malpractice, which is quite a different situation from this upstream clinical intervention that we're talking about. I believe they have a requirement of both physicians who are on the hospital staff and in the medical school, and patients coming into the hospital when they are admitted. They sign an agreement indicating that they won't sue before they try in good faith to meet.
Even as an outpatient, because I was an outpatient.
Oh, is that true? You signed it for
yeah,
there?
I had never seen this doctor before, and they said, before you do anything, we want you to read this carefully and sign it.